The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome to The Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 53. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am your host for this and, all of the podcasts, I guess. We have some great guests that we have always had enjoyed to bring to you, and today is no different. We have a gentleman who is the head of the Mutual Fund Research Division of Morningstar, Russ Cannell. Cannell is going to be joining us in a moment after we get through a few pieces of mail. I have some mail. Actually, I got my first piece of, I don't know if this hate mail. This is just not, we'll call it dislike mail. But I'm going to read that to you in a second. And of course, if you want to get in touch with me at any time, and give me some advice, give me some feedback, or just anything at all, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's the best place to get in touch with me. All right, so like I said, we've been relatively negative on the market for some time here, and rightfully so, I believe, mostly dealing with many of the economic indicators and economic issues that have been in front of us. And I think that, most of that's not going to Not going to let up too soon. We did see a really wonderful week last week and capped off by the Google earnings and really skyrocketed. I mean, I think we ended up, 92 points on Google last week. And so IBM did pretty well and a variety of the other banking industries. We did, in fact, see a incredibly negative, or at least a negative, report by Capital One Financial. If you've been following my discussion on that, whether it's through the blog on AOL or whatever else I've been talking about here on this podcast, you realize that I've been very negative on Capital One, and rightfully so, it seems. Write-downs have been extraordinarily large, and in the face of an incredibly strong a market that just went directly up on Friday, we saw Capital One take down about a point and a half. And that may not seem like a lot, but realize it was about 53 when I first recommended the short on it, and now it's in the 47.5 range, I believe it is. And I do think that if the markets do stabilize here or even track back just slightly, Capital One will be in some really sorry shape. We have a price tag, a look at about the $40 range you should be looking at it. And right now, I think that you can get about a 20 or an 18% return on the short side of things. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to read some of these hate mails and some of these other mails that go along with this. Then we're going to get to our interview with Russ Cannell and then to the Zach Zone. So here we go. Let's start with this. This gentleman, his name is Michael N. And he says, Andrew, I can no longer listen to your podcast. I think you're smart, have a great guest, and provide good information. But I think that if I hear one more doomsday forecast, I may just have to end it all. Oh, Mike, I'm sorry. I realize that things are not going as good now as they have been in the past. We may face challenges, but some of us would like to think that possibly things will get better eventually, and we may be able to go and see the sun rise again after all. I honestly don't think that we are going to starve to death before the huge oil producers take over the world. The credit crisis eviscerates us as a country. The economy falls into recession and the dollar becomes worthless. Why not try being optimistic for once? There has to be something good about what is happening now or some sort of positive sign on the horizon. Wouldn't it be nice to look on the bright side again for once? Sincerely, Mike. Mike, I got to tell you, I was only kidding about all the things I said, buddy. I mean, the things aren't that bad. Oh, my God, you took me seriously? Come on. I mean, look at this. The fact is that I was just testing you. Mike, wake up. Buddy boy, listen. The fact of the matter is, I don't mean to be a jerk and really negative and all that, but I'm trying to make money here for everybody, right? Isn't that what we're here for? I'm here to learn. We're here to make money. We're not here to just play nicey-nice. The fact is, there's plenty of things we can do to make money and to do well, and that's what I like to do. On the negative issues, fine. I would much rather things be great. I would much rather the whole market just continue to move right up like we saw last week when it came to the announcement of the earnings with Google and of IBM of late and a variety of the other companies that came out with earnings. But the fact of the matter is, my friend, that we are in a heap of trouble because the financial part of our economy, the blood that's flowing through, if you will, of our economic system is halted because it's a big fat clog, a big cholesterol clog that we call the credit markets that are just absolutely stagnating right now. Why is that? Well, because we were on a mad binge for a number of years. So, yeah, there's plenty of bright things. I think the technology sector is good. I think that we're going to probably make a turn in the healthcare sector right now. But economically and domestically, we have a big problem. Bright side, Europe maybe? No, I don't think so. Bahamas? No. It was New York real estate for a while, but that's not doing so well all of a sudden. And I think that while I would hope that you would continue to listen, and I hope that you wouldn't take this negativity as a lifelong permabear situation, my friend, you face it as more of a reality of what we're trying to get through. Because I'll tell you, if I was to sit here and just be nicey-nice and tell you that things are okay, you know what? I wouldn't have gotten tons of emails that I got in thanking me for the amount of money that I saved people since June of last year, the amount of money that they made from my shorts that I told them to get, from the things that they pulled out of the market because it was really just a bad time. If I was just here being nice, well, I'd be on the Oprah Winfrey show or something. I mean, I would be the Oprah Winfrey money hour maybe. That's not what this is all about. We're here to be honest and open. We're here to communicate what's going on in these markets. And I'm here to tell you, as best of my ability, which isn't always perfect, it isn't always right, what I see and how I see it. I'm going to call it as I see it. So I'm sorry, and I hope the rest of you appreciate it. I don't know. If you're getting tired of me talking about the negatives, I apologize. Let me know, because I'll hopefully bring it to a different level. I will tell you this. We do have the Zach Zone, who's been positive on a few different things lately, and that's been very, very good. So maybe just kind of skip ahead in the future to the Zach Zone, and we can help you out. Here's another email I received. Andrew, who's this from? Let's see. This is from Ed. Andrew, I am still very skeptical about the stock market, having lost too much over the last year. Can you do a show or recommend a place to put money that's safe? See, these are the kind of emails that I get all the time, by the way. And Mike, you know, I realize that, again, just to get back, this is not to beat a dead horse here. The fact is that people are really hurting right now. We're trying to get them into a really good place. That's what's really going on, and that's the real world. I don't know if you've invested any money or just an idealistic kind of college freshman that's just out there just trying to see how great the world is. But unfortunately, step outside a little bit, my friend. Step outside your confined area, and that's what you were seeing. People are losing money, and we're trying to help them. Answer your question, Ed. How to make some money? How to make sure it's safe? Why don't you look at many of the banks, obviously, FDIC, we'll get to that. I have an email coming up about that in a second, too. But in terms of safe right now, cash, money market, CDs, treasuries, put your money in treasuries, T-bills that are short-term and maybe the intermediate-term treasury bonds or bills, I should say, notes, really to stick to, if you want safe, if that's what you're looking for, some of the municipal bonds, get the high-rated municipal bonds, tax-freeze, and I think you'll be fine. CDs of the quality banks, of course, under the 100,000 or whatever the exact number that you're looking for in terms of your FDIC insurance levels. And from there, I think you'll be fine. This one is from Daniel. Daniel says the United States has the world's largest debt. Our economy is in recession. It is in an effort to jumpstart the economy. The government is borrowing money to give to consumers. The financial industry is going through a crisis. I feel safe putting my emergency funds, a 6-month worth of expenses, in a savings account because it is FDIC insured. What is the what if the majority of the banks went under and millions of Americans asked the government to keep its word on FDIC insured bank accounts? Are FDIC funds really secure considering current and future debts of our government? Great question. Again, a negative connotation, I guess, here. But here's the answer to that. The FDIC, just like Social Security, has a funding amount that they have put aside to look at, what are their obligations. If all of the major banks went under, I think that we wouldn't have to worry about FDIC. I mean, let's be very honest about that. There's a certain level that you have to say, you know what, that really isn't possible. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to be anywhere near what's going to happen. We may have some failures like we're seeing in the airline industry, the consolidation and the failures, the banking industry, the failures and the potential consolidation and the continuation of the consolidation in the banking sector. And I do not think that we're going to see a lot of failures. Do yourself a favor, though. If you are concerned about that, obviously put your money in the banks that you believe at, with quotes, I'm doing the if you, quote, believe, that it is a concerning time right now. Find the banks that you feel are the most solid. The big boys, Bank of America, is not going anywhere, even though they did purchase countrywide. They have some problems there. But, you know, look at the big national banks, the national banks that have very little credit exposure or the least credit exposure as possible. And then I think you're going to be in good shape there. But you know what? You set up a scenario, Daniel, that is hard to really envision. And even if we did envision that, I think that we'd have more problems than really could. I mean, just it would be bad, very bad if it got to that point. So, you know, with that in mind, we're going to, I hope he was a little more positive, maybe not, take that mail and just toss it, I guess. But if you want to write me, ask Andrew at thedisciplineinvestor.com. And we're going to have a new site up very soon. Thank you for coming in and visiting. The new site is awesome. We have a team of designers that did just an amazing job on the site. So come on and check it out at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Midweek, we're going to have it up and running. So they tell me. And thank you again for picking up my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Do yourself a favor. You want to learn about, let's say, the mutual funds that we're going to talk about in a minute. I have a chapter that's dedicated to mutual funds that'll knock your socks off. You go pick up a copy at Amazon. The Disciplined Investor is like, I don't know, $15 or so on sale right now at Amazon. And I bet you you're going to be very, very happy. Do yourself a favor. Do me a favor. That's how we support the show. Go get yourself a copy of the book. We'll be right back with an interview with Morningstar's Russ Kinnell. We're talking here. We're doing our best to be positive and optimistic on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or your favorite bookstore. The Disciplined Investor. Together, we will reach success.
All right, we're back with Russ Kinnell with Morningstar, who is the head of mutual fund research. We'll talk about that in a minute and get his exact titling. Make sure I got it right, because I thought we'd do what we do today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast is switch it up a bit. We talk about stocks a lot, and obviously the markets have been quite kind to some and quite brutal to others, but I thought we'd switch it up to talk more about the baseline asset allocation and talk about mutual funds. So, Russ, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, Morningstar. For those people who don't know, who maybe, I don't know what they're doing that they don't know what Morningstar is, but tell me a little bit about Morningstar and what they do and what you do.
Sure. Morningstar analyzes a wide array of financial securities, from options to stocks to mutual funds, which we're probably best known for. We track funds. We have lots of portfolio data that we provide. We create the star rating, which people know us best for, which on the mutual fund side is a purely quantitative measure of risk and return over trailing 3, 5, and 10 years. We also have fund analyst picks, which is a purely forward-looking qualitative effort of the fund analyst, in which we're selecting our best picks for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
I head up our picks effort, and I also edit a monthly Morningstar Fund Investor, which is a monthly newsletter for individual investors.
So when we talk about the mutual funds, let's kind of get down to some of the criteria. One of the things that Morningstar has always done great is the visuals, you know, to take a look at a glance what's happening inside a fund. So for example, obviously, if you want to pick up a large cap, a small cap, you have your style box, which is always very helpful. And then you have other parameters, and a lot of it, the Morningstar rating is risk return, right? It's risk reward, I should say, parameters.
That's right. It's we adjust for loads and risk, and then we grade funds on a curve within their category.
Right.
The category derived rating.
So let's talk a little bit about mutual funds. Let's talk about some of the things that have gone on over the years. You know, I've been in this business, I don't know, 20, 25 years or so. And when mutual funds really started to first, you know, kind of come on the scene and was really exciting back then and dealing with asset allocation, there was a lot of, you know, there was less of the no-load universe. You know, in other words, there was more loaded funds out there. And I remember way back when I was at a meeting one time, I was with American Funds, a great group, you know, capital management. And they said, I remember the guy standing up at the front of the room saying, you know what, we will never go no load. And I said, really? I wonder why that is. I mean, what kind of a statement is that, you know? He said, absolutely not. American Funds will never go no load. Well, When I saw them go no load, I realized that the universe obviously was changing dramatically, right? I not only with my clients, we only use no load funds, but you know, there's a significant difference. Why would anybody utilize load funds? I know maybe that's a touchy subject from an analyst standpoint where you are, but I mean, why is anybody still these days using loaded mutual funds?
I think simply because they want advice. Obviously you can, get advice, you know, and pay a fee and then get no load funds too. But, I think a lot of people, want advice and they want help because they feel like they don't have the time or understanding to manage their investments themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think they get the peace of mind from knowing that someone's watching over. Obviously, in reality, we know that there's enormous variety of quality of advice that you can get. Some people, I think, are getting good value for their advice, and other people are getting really, really poor value. And I think also with load funds, if you have a high investment to make in a load fund, then you don't have to pay all of the load, so that becomes less of an issue.
Right. So let's talk about now. I, one of the things that is really fascinating to me is there's a lot of changes that happened. There was no, for a number of years, or forever, there was no shorting allowed in mutual funds, right? And then what right. year was that changed over?
Let's see, I think it was 97 or 98 that the short rule was dropped.
Recently, obviously. And one of the things that happened was that now we were allowed to have quasi-hedging going on, you know, not significantly leveraged per se, but just, you know, you have different funds that do different things. And the market neutral funds are the ones that have really, in my opinion, been great through this horrible market condition, without naming too many, but there's a few of them. I like the Gateway Fund as an example. As a quasi market neutral, they do an option based strategy against the S&P, of course. But there has been a couple of these that have really, which were titled market neutral, you know, that have kind of blown up during this recent. I think the hybrid statistical kind of had this huge problem. They're quantitative based. And back in the summer, what was the problem with some of these? What happened with regard to, you know, I don't think they went against their charter per se, but, you know, I guess, what is it, the quant just didn't pan out?
Yeah, I think both long, short, and market neutral, we've seen really wide variety of both strategies and just quality of funds. You mentioned Gateway is one that has this proven strategy that actually does seem to work pretty dependably, but one of the problems with market neutral or long short is that typically you've got higher fees because of shorting and leverage,
right?
And you're essentially magnifying manager skill. If, say, the fund is 100% long and 100% short, then when you think about it, if a typical long fund might charge, say, 100 basis points, and they have this tailwind that, you know, market's going to go up 6 to 10%, somewhere like that, in a typical year, so that they're starting off at, you know, 5 to 9% ahead of the game, just assuming they do no harm, you know, just at a neutral spot. Whereas a market neutral fund, they're starting off, say, 200 basis points in the hole, and manager selection has to do everything to get them just into positive territory. Mm-hmm. So we've seen various quantitative programs and others that, you know, they just didn't do that well, and whereas in a long-only fund that might have led to an innocuous 6% return, in a market-neutral fund, you know, maybe they're minus 3 or 4% just starting out. We've seen some funds that you know, have a value bias. We've seen some that just the programs haven't done that well at selecting winning stocks, and you end up with some pretty lousy results.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, obviously, it's the proof's in the pudding on everything, because I straddle, you know, in my book, I have a whole chapter called Why Mutual Funds, and it starts out with the whole discussion about, you know, obviously mutual funds helping to create a well-diversified portfolio, because, and by the way, this comes at chapter 6. This is past stock, understanding stocks from a quantitative, a fundamental, a technical standpoint. Now we're up to mutual funds. And the big issue here that I think that I like to see in mutual funds is obviously performance, but there's this huge controversy that continually goes on between fees and, you know, ultimate performance, because I do believe that essentially the lower the fees are, or at least the leaner the fees are, the better the performance, and that's been proven time after time. On the other hand, though, you know, we've seen times when there have been funds that have had, let's just say, you know, a 3.5-4% fee, just something outrageous, okay? But yet they're turning in, you know, 25-30% net returns. And, you know, you wonder, well, I mean, what you know, do we have to keep on running towards low fees only? I think it's important. But I think that to tail on the discussion of your, you know, about that we're starting out maybe 200 basis points in the hole with the market neutral or a long short fund. The question is, you know, did they not lose 10%? I mean, what's the average market neutral short long short fund done the first quarter? Not too badly, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think when it comes to fees, you can always find some examples of high cost funds that succeeded, but in truth, they're very few. And I did a study a year ago where I accounted for something that's not normally done in fee studies, and that is survivorship bias, because high cost funds tend to do, they either fail, in which case they tend to be liquidated, or they, you know, happen to take big risks that pay off, in which case, you know, they succeed. And so you miss a lot of that if you're just looking at the funds that still exist today. So what I did was I said, what are the chances that, based on breaking funds into quintiles based on expenses, what are the chances of success in each quintile? That is, that a fund survives and outperforms its peer groups.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the cheapest quintile, you get about a 50-50 shot. In the highest cost quintile, only 1 in 5 succeeds. So, in other words, if you think about it, that means your odds are 2.5 times better in the cheapest quintile. And even going from the cheapest quintile to the next cheapest quintile, you still have a significant drop in, right, in your odds of success.
Well, I mean, I'm always in favor of the, as a matter of fact, I have a whole, I think, 5 pages that I've written about, you know, why you want to have lower costs, and I bang it into the heads of my readers. And as a matter of fact, I'm just kind of thumbing through page 142. I have this whole maximum total fee that you want to pay on any particular fund. So what I've done is I've created this thing called FundSort, which is, you know, it's basically a screener, you know, where if you follow some basic parameters, whether using the Morningstar screener, for example, which is a great tool, at Morningstar.com, and then you kind of try to filter out some of the expensive funds, et cetera, I think often going to be better off. I do have a question for you. You know, style drift used to be a really big issue when you're trying to set up an asset allocation where you have a portfolio that is based on, let's just say, you know, large cap or small cap. Or there was a time when many of these funds had, or some funds had incorrectly titled funds, names, titles, you know, the name of the fund. I think there was a time when the Legg Mason Value Trust was, you know, a growth-oriented fund, or there was a time when the Franklin Small Cap Growth Fund was really a large cap fund. I mean, is that still a problem these days? I mean, how do you see that?
Well, the name issue is much less of a problem because a few years ago, the SEC said that various names come with certain obligations. In other words, you must put 80% of your assets in the type of stock implied by that name. So you couldn't run, say, a small cap fund that's now large cap. Now, not everything is triggered by that. For instance, the word income doesn't trigger that test, so you don't have to have any yield on a fund that says income. But words like small cap or technology or regional, if you're Fidelity Europe, you have to own 80% in Europe.
Right.
So that addresses it somewhat. But obviously there are lots of other funds with really vague names like Ultra and
Strategic.
When you think about
Strategic.
Those kind of funds, right. Obviously there's no name obligation,
right.
But we have seen greater discipline, I think, over the last 20 years, that the industry has become more influenced by institutional strategies and management. And institutions mean much more discipline, that you are very explicit about your investment universe and your strategy, and you do not veer from that, because if pension, if you're running a pension fund and you have allocated $500 million to small value and the small value manager decides to buy big cap tech, you're not going to be happy. So we've seen that a little greater discipline from the fund companies, so that style drift is, I think, much less of an issue. It's still an issue, but it's much less of an issue today.
Well, you know, I probably need to get you a copy of my book, because not that I'm harping on this, but the mutual fund chapter in particular is very relevant when I talk to you. And I talk about the Morningstar tax efficiency ratio on page 149, describing what it is. And I think it's a great tool, because I remember when it first came out, and I said, wow, that is terrific, because on one hand, we're really always taught to buy and hold. That's the basic mantra of long-term investing, right? But at the same time, you know, you have a mutual fund, which inherently could have a tax trap that you don't know about until it's too late. So Morningstar came out with this wonderful tool, a wonderful statistic called the Morningstar tax efficiency ratio. So last year, what I noticed was there was a lot of inefficiency going on. It was this kind of weird year that there was a great up in the beginning, and then it kind of tailed off the year and then came back towards the end, if you remember, you know, in 2007. And it seemed that mutual funds, not all of them, but a lot of them really just plowed through capital gains. Did you see that?
Right. Yeah, definitely. I keep track of capital gains trends, and distributions have ticked up in each of the last 5 years. And what you have kind of a double impact from the fact that the bear market is fading into history, because what that means is since then, funds have built up more gains, you know, particularly small value or emerging markets, where they've really made a lot of money, so that you just have made a lot of money. But also, in the bear market, funds that lost money were able to take tax charge-offs, but a lot of them have used that up, so that they no longer have the charge of us, and at the same time, they've made a lot of money. So you definitely have seen that continuing to go up. And really, I kind of think of tax distributions as kind of telling you, where has a fund been the last 3 or 5 years? If they made a lot of money over the last 3 or 5 years, you're probably getting a hefty payout. Mm-hmm. And right now, it's still most heavy in international. So that's probably where you want to be the most careful is, most international funds, even though they made big payouts last year, they've still got a lot of built-up gains. So I would expect, unless the market goes down a lot more this year, that international is going to have a big payout at the end of the year.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, and that's not necessarily a good thing, because it could be a phantom payout. But I want to ask you about international, because I have been warning people that I believe, aside from the fact that you're telling me now, and even more reaffirms my concern, not just from an investment standpoint. All right, you know, we got to take that and put that aside. You know, whatever the international markets do, they do, and whether what we believe they're good or bad. But there's an inherently built-up gain from a currency conversion standpoint, as I see it, and I'd like you to either confirm that or just allow me to throw it out the window. But it seems to me that over the last number of years, with the fact that the dollar is in the toilet at this point, that anybody that invested money into an international fund, and specifically in Europe, now we'll talk about, could have more recently invested could have a phantom income when and if they take their money out, or if in fact the dollar goes reverses. Do you agree with that?
Well, it shouldn't be an issue with taking your money out because I mean the NAV is already reflected back in the dollar terms, so that shouldn't be an issue. But it would be an issue that, as you say, the dollar's gone down for so long that you could get a snapback. And I think some people, when they're buying international funds and looking at those recent returns, they don't realize how much of that was pumped up by a falling dollar. And while it always seems, that after a long move that's just going to keep happening forever, of course, that's not the way markets work. Markets correct and rotate, and you could well have, a scenario where for the next 5 years, instead of falling, the dollar starts to rise, and then you've got a headwind for all the international funds, and that's going to mean much more modest returns. Mm-hmm. I think you need to appreciate that going in. There are a few foreign funds that hedge most of their exposure, but the vast majority are unhedged, and therefore you are getting that currency risk.
Yeah, that's a great thing you mentioned, that most people think linearly, you know, like kind of if it's going down, it's always going down. If it's going up, it's always going to go up, right?
Right. That investing with a ruler right. like the last year's right. returns is not a good way to make your projections.
Right. I want to ask you one other oddball question. This is going to be totally an oddball question, and I want to ask you, how do we work with Morningstar? I have noticed, and maybe it's just me, but whenever the market starts to kind of tank and have all sorts of problems, the CGM Focus Fund by Ken Huebner with the guys with the fencing, you know, they do the fencing on the TV. Does that always seem to appear when that happens? Is it just me that those commercials just come out of the woodwork from how those are old commercials, right? I mean, they just seem every single time the market starts doing badly, I see those commercials. Do you notice that?
I have not noticed that. No.
I believe there's a marketing. I do. I'm not even kidding about this. I believe because he's had some reasonable. I mean, some good performance. He has, but I believe that there's some correlation to at least what they have found when people are looking for alternatives. And I think that if I'm not mistaken, he does pretty well in the downdrafts.
I mean, he's got some shorting abilities in some of his funds, and therefore, in some of those down markets, the fund looks particularly good. You know, like. Not that last year was an actual down market, but he was shorting Countrywide, you know, and his longs were things like energy stocks. So, you know, he had the Midas touch last year. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
If you talk to him, you should ask him that, and if you could just ping me back one day, if that's true. I just find that to be, again, you know, it could be totally wrong. I could just be just noticing that, but whatever.
If so, I give him points for a clever marketing strategy.
I agree. Okay, last thing. So now, how is, Morningstar offers just a ton of tools, and actually your tools are available, like on the MSN Money site that I recommend. What is, you know, if somebody wants to look for mutual funds, first of all, I'm gonna use a huge disclaimer. Do not go after only 5-star high performers initially. I think people kind of want the easy way out, the black box technique. And I know probably while you guys are really good at it, I just think that, and I hope you agree, that you know people shouldn't be looking blindly just at that. They should do a little bit more research.
I agree 100%. Okay. The star rating is a useful tool. In my latest article, and I call it Mutual Fund Helper, it can help you along. It gives you a good glimpse of the past risk-adjusted performance, but don't ask it to do everything for you. It's right. not designed to do that. Right. So, but most definitely, it won't substitute for the legwork you need to do. It'll help you along. But
so what should an investor who's looking to, you know, let's talk about people who, you know, either don't know or moderately kind of have an idea of what Morningstar is all about. What's the first thing they should be doing, and what's the, you know, your recommendation on how they should utilize your services?
Yeah, there's a few angles. Obviously, you need to develop a plan for building your portfolio before you start picking funds. But once you're ready to start picking funds, you can go to our site or go to Fund Investor and start to research. And there's a few ways to do it. If you want to cut to the chase for a few good ideas, you can use our fund analyst picks, which are available in Fund Investor and the premium portion of our website. And that gives you about 170 of our favorite funds. And so you can just go, if you need mid-growth, you can just go to the mid-growth picks and help yourself there. But we also have screener tools so you can set your criteria. We talked about costs. So obviously you want to say, look for funds with low costs. You can screen on good performance, management experience, things like that. Screen on a sales channel, say you want just no load, et cetera. So you can narrow that universe down. And I think you just want to focus on the fundamentals, things like expenses, management, strategy. Find a fund that you're comfortable with. Go look at all of its past returns so that you understand not just how it did last year, but how did it do in the bear market? How did it do in the dot-com bubble, et cetera? So that you really understand what were the biggest losses it suffered, because you don't want to get in a fund that can lose a lot more than you can take.
Yep, I hear you. All right, and Claude, we're going to put all this information, I'm going to put a lot of the information about where they can link up to Morningstar on our show notes for this at thedisciplinedinvestor.com for this episode. But last question, I'll let you go. ETFs, I know that's not your specialty. But you know, do you see a, it seems like the ETFs are starting to match or at least get closer in matching to some of what the funds have done. And by allowing for intraday trading, is that a bit of a big distraction for the open-end mutual fund companies?
Well, yeah, I think ETFs are, and we analyze ETFs too. I think they are taking away from stocks and futures as much as from mutual funds. But you know, I think there is some that, you know, on the one hand, there, some of them are very nice long-term investment vehicles, mm-hmm. but obviously a lot of people are instead, you know, going there for the speculation, the Vegas side of it, because you can buy incredibly narrow, niche vehicles and hold them for 3 hours. And
how about 3 minutes?
I mean, that's the truth.
The doubling, the leveraging of it, the you know, the pro fund style, or the, you know, that kind of where you can get double the S&P or double the finance. I mean, listen, you SKF, you see what happened in the last number of weeks when Lehman was going a little berserky and all that. I mean, those things were all over the place.
Yeah, and I think the ETF industry has kind of taken leave of their senses with this great land rush of mm-hmm. throwing everything possible out there, you know, all mm-hmm. sorts of crazy ETFs. It doesn't matter because they want to rush out and be the first to have Western Canadian gold stocks whose names start with S ETF,
right, and
so this crazy stuff out there. But there are, you can treat it like a casino, or you can treat it like a good long-term savings vehicle.
Yeah, I just hope there's no kind of weird thing. You know, whenever we see this kind of thing where there's so much focus and so much of a, as you say, the rush, there's always some little gotcha there somewhere. I don't know what it is, but this seems there's potential.
And many of these funds are going to be liquidated over time. You mm-hmm. know, they're throwing stuff out there, and in a year or two, when a lot of them are going to realize they're just not going to make a profit off them, they're going to be gone.
Right. Well, I appreciate your time, Russ Cannell, right? That's how you pronounce it?
Yes.
From Morningstar. I appreciate it, and keep in touch. And like I said, I'll put all the links on the site and get over to Morningstar. Morningstar is a great resource. I'm a big fan. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. The Zach Zone is sponsored by Newsflasher.com, a new way to view headline news from all the major news sources. Get a wide-angle view of all the hot topics making news by viewing just a single page. Newsflasher. It's as quick as a flash. Type the word newsflash, then the letter R.com, and see for yourself. The Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com. So Zach, tell me what's going on this week. How are things going?
We're in the money. This guy's... Hey, I'm sorry, Andrew. I'll quit singing, but I have to tell you, I am excited. Stearman is off to a great start in the second quarter, and we've been trading stocks that have been issued recently within the past couple of years, and we've been making a killing so far just this month. We've talked before about Blackstone and Fortress Investment Group. Both of these are relatively new issues. They've been out for only a couple of years, or less than 2 years for both of them. And at the same time, they are making some serious money by holding on to private companies that they're going to be able to turn out over the next few months as the liquidity comes into the market, and as buyers are out there and there's a market for their private investments, they're going to make a killing. So anyway, we're making money on those, and I think there's farther to go. We talked about the solars a couple of weeks ago. JA Solar and YGE, Yingling Green Energy. Those are two names that I've been involved in, and we've been making some serious money there too. They're both at new recovery highs. And I think the one that you want to continue to play if you're going to stay in this area is the YGE. And finally, we've been trading the shippers. Diana Shipping, Dry Ships, Euroseas, that's DSX for Diana, DRYS for Dry Ships, and ESEA for Euroseas. All three of these companies are shipping companies that basically buy the large dry bulk or Handymax ships, and then they lease these ships out to producers and consumers who need to ship the goods back and forth, and they lease them out at day rates, and the day rates are climbing, and that means that these companies are making profits. So those are some great companies that are coming out of basing patterns, and you still have a chance to make some money there. So we've been trading from the long side. We've been making a good bit of money there, but there's also a bear thesis out there, and I'm assuming that this is a bear market rally. It doesn't mean you can't make money in it, but we've got some pain that we've still got to go through. We're still in the very early stages of a credit unwind, and while a lot of bulls are going to point to Friday's really positive move on strong volume, as confirmation that we're out of the bear market, you have to realize that Friday was expiration day, options expiration day, and that means that you've got a lot of cross currents going on, that volume's automatically going to be much higher. And I don't think you can put too much meaning into that move. We've got to wait and see what things look like next week and if the markets are really able to break out of this range that they've been trading in. As far as new issues are concerned, this next week is huge. We have 5 IPOs and 2 secondaries coming out next week. So there's going to be a lot of activity. And I just want to point out a few names that you need to be aware of if you're trading this area. The first one is American Water Works. We talked a little bit about this last week. This company is not profitable, but they cover most of the water treatment and water distribution in the United States. They're the largest privately held or investor-owned water utility. And I think that they are too big and too important to fail. So the underwriters are going to price them at a really attractive rate, and they're going to pop. So if you can get stock on the deal, I think it's a good, worthwhile buy. However, I'm not sure that I'd buy it in the aftermarket because, like I said, they are not profitable, and it's going to take some work to get this company turned around and making money. The second one that I'm going to point out is Whiting Petroleum, WHX. This is a real non-traditional IPO. It's a trust that actually holds energy assets, and so they make their cash flow through these energy different exploration and different assets that hold crude oil or natural gas. And it should do quite well, even though it's not a traditional company. It should do very well just because this area is a very important area and one that investors are looking at very closely. The third one is the one that you cannot pass up. It's Intrepid Potash, IPI. Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, these guys are all on the deal, and they've got a huge distribution list. So they're going to get the stock out, and it's going to do well. There's going to be a lot of people that want stock that don't get stock. In fact, I really hope that I get enough stock. I've been banging on the desk and asking all my contacts at these different brokerage houses to get me stock. I think that it's one that you got to be watching both on the IPO and in the aftermarket. There should be a great opportunity to make money over the next several months in this name. So for more information on these stocks that I'm talking about today and more new issues or companies that have come out in the last 3 to 5 years, please give me a visit at zachstocks.com. That's Z-A-C-H stocks.com. And Andrew, thanks for having me on.
Hey, Zach, my pleasure. You've done a great job. I tell you something, we looked at those stocks from last week and you did awesome. That is really cool. Everybody, that if you haven't had the opportunity to check out the picks, check out the picks. They're always in the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com for this episode, and we'll make sure to highlight those for you from Zach, who is covering the new issues and the hottest stocks in the market right now. So some cool stuff. If you've had any experience, anybody's done anything good with these stocks, do me a favor, send me an email. I'd like to know what's going on here about your good news and some of the things that are working out for you. And other than that, we're going to take it to the end of this show. End of this episode, episode 53. Thanks a lot for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Lots lined up. Again, if you have any questions or anything that you need to discuss with me, feel free to email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.